traveling the world searching for equestrians of all breeds. The journey starts now on the International Equine Network.
The Keeneland September sale is a unique sale in that it has 4,500 horses that sell over approximately 2 weeks. And it's really unlike any sale in the world, and it requires kind of patience and viewing it like a marathon. My name is Jason Litt, and I'm with Solis Litt Bloodstock. I work with Alex Solis and Madison Scott, and we are out here at the Keeneland September sale hunting down some hopefully very fast horses.
First impressions essentially go a long way. If you're going to put it on a scale of 100 and a percentage, for me, that first impression is, I would have to say, right at about 60%. I am Nick Hines. Some of you may know me as the Sarge. I work as an analyst host at TVG, as well as a bloodstock advisor at MyRacehorse.com. Denominator is trying to find that game changer, and within that game changer is trying to find value. Sometimes they don't end up being on the same page. In particular, when you're looking at book one, you know, breaking it up into two sessions, trying to find value and trying to find that game changer, it's a very difficult blend.
The Keeneland September sale is comprised of six books. Book one, you get the best physical types and you get the best pedigrees. It's a combination of both, but you're going to have to pay for it as well. Book two, you're still getting those really nice physical types, and you're also getting those nice pedigrees as well. And then when you get to book three to six, you get a little bit more bang for your buck.
The reality is trying to find a physical that can match up with a pedigree, but once that physical matches up with a highlighted pedigree, then you can do the math.
You can find a great horse from any book at the Keeneland September sale, even authentic. He came from book three.
This is a projection. Obviously, you're looking at pedigree, but you're also looking at the athlete, too. But a lot of people compare, like, looking at a high school basketball player. Is he going to become the next Michael Jordan, or is he not?
Hi, I'm Joe Mishak, Racing Operations Manager with My Racehorse.
We started out discussing in the office, are people going to like this idea? Are people going to want to participate with the micro-share concept? And when people kind of latched onto it, we said, what can we do next to take it to the next level? We want to compete on the biggest stages. We need to partner with the best people in the industry.
Michael approached us about a year and a half ago. We set up a meeting with Mr. Hughes. He loved the concept. His feeling is that this is something that can be bigger than the NFL. I'm Ned Toffee, General Manager at Spendthrift Farm. When we are partnering on a horse, it's very important that both parties are happy with the individual. So Spendthrift has its own inspection team, and My Racehorse has its own inspection team.
There are a lot of people that will look at a catalog, mark out horses that they want to see, but we're really coming at this from the approach of any horse can be a runner, so we look at everything.
We separate out our team of three or four. We separate out into, 150 horses apiece. We take a look at them, pretty much every horse offered for sale. We inspect them. Again, it's what we call form and function.
But you kind of want to look at this like track and field, that the 100 and 200 meter dash, they have a different physical look than the 400 to 1500, and then the 1500 to 10,000 meters, they're all different. And then, of course, add in a different surface, they're really quite a variety of horses that exist, and then throw in new sires. So right now, you have a bunch of new sires that are coming in, Gunrunner, Arrogate. So they're a completely new look that we've never seen before.
When I'm evaluating horses, one of the most important things that I like to see is balance. When I look at balance, I'm sort of drawing a line at about the withers on the horse, and I want to look at how much horses to the right of that line and how much horses to the left of that line.
Do they have the makeup physically to what we think are going to withstand training? Are they, proportional from the front to the withers, their midsection, and then the back end? How do they move? How do they walk? If there is some, conformational traits, which obviously there always is, no horse is perfect, and if it is, you're going to pay a lot of money for it.
You like to see a reasonably correct horse. In other words, those limbs line up pretty well. When that horse walks at you, he comes at you rather than being towed out or towed in too much.
Obviously, by a book of standards, when you talk about horses being back at the knee, over at the knee, bench knee, offset, crooked, towing in, sickle hocked, out in the hocks, short back. There are so many sway back. There's so many different characteristics, but there are so many horses in that mix that you can contend with. When you talk about the dynamics of a racehorse that hits at 5,000 pounds per square inch, if a horse is back at the knee, just imagine sitting at a table and the table is a little crooked as far as the legs, and the more weight you put on top of that table, the chances are it won't withstand that.
Really, at the end of the day, you're looking for an animal that gives you that kind of tingly feeling in your stomach. And that's really so much of this. The beauty of the game is there's a science to it. And clearly, have a vet look at them and make sure they're sound. There are companies that will scan their heart to see how their heart looks. There are companies that do a biometric analysis.
No horse is perfect. And so it's very important that we have a vet that works with us in pointing out all of the imperfections that we can live with. We like to see a good functioning throat on a horse, and your throats are difficult to evaluate. They can change dramatically in a short period of time. But understanding what you can live with and what you can't live with, and a good veterinarian is really key in that process. Same thing with evaluating the x-rays. These horses' ankles, knees, hocks, and stifles are all x-rayed. All those films are on file here for our veterinarians to examine.
But then there's also the art of this, and this isn't a science completely. There's a lot of feel, there's a lot of gut feeling, and there's a lot of looking at the animal and gauging, do you think this thing will fight for you? Because at the end of the day, we're looking for athletes, and you want a horse that's going to want to compete.
There are many things that could come up in a vet report. For example, Justify, I believe he sold here at Keeneland for $500,000. If he had a perfect vet report, you probably could have multiplied that by 4 easily.
When we determine a budget on a given individual, we're looking at the pedigree, the confirmation. We'll go back and we'll look at the sales averages for that sire, the sales history for the dam, and we'll use those numbers to come up with a price range.
At this point in time, the market is overcompensating for age of mares. It used to be people didn't worry about that, but now, if you notice the prices, a lot of these young mares are having their offspring bring premium dollar because they're thinking that there's a plus in that. So we're looking at it from a standpoint of that might be a really good value play to get an older mare that's proven she can get it done.
Being a McDonald's All-American Band finalist, March is essentially what I know. So when I see a horse coming to the back ring, I'm looking for cadence. I'm looking for horses that don't break cadence. I'm looking for horses that are not rattled by the noise, nor bothered by the people that surround them, nor the other horses that are here. So what I see there needs to happen in this ring as far as not breaking cadence. And if they can march up there without breaking cadence, then I'm on to the next phase.
Once they get up there and get in the ring, you want to be aware of who else may be bidding on this horse. You've got a price in mind. We usually set a max number that we go in there with. And you know, you want to make sure that you're going to get the best price that you can.
It is absolutely a poker match, because the seller's job, from a consignor standpoint, is to identify the buyers, and that's going to dictate where they might put a reserve. So the last thing you want to do is let them know that you love this horse, because they might go to the owner and say, hey, so lease lit's on it, those guys are willing to spend a lot of money, let's bump the reserve. So there's a lot of jockeying and bluffing and faking people out, and there are enough bidding spots at Keeneland, you can really kind of hide it.
Feels a little bit like game day. You get a little excited, especially when you've got a really special horse coming into the ring. But you've got a job to do, and you want to make sure you go about it in the best way to get that horse and get it for the best price that you can. Oftentimes, the bidding is, if it's moving very quickly, as a bidder, you may want to try to slow it down a little bit. If the auctioneer sense too much enthusiasm, you may be prone to that price jumping up on you a little bit.
Here's music. The end. I have in the back 360,000.
Song of Bird, Rachel Alexandra, Ethan Katz, Marketing Mix, Honor Pretty, New Money,
that's good press. We're happy for that. Deer Park.
Nothing better than to try to fake someone out. You end up buying it, and they come around and see you signing the ticket and think, oh, man, we didn't know that was you guys.
When you sign a ticket throughout the process, it's equivalent to being in the winner's circle. There's no better feeling. It's an adrenaline rush, and the sky's the limit.
It is a great feeling for a moment, and then you realize you need to be right. Because this is just the start. At buying the horse is essentially buying a lottery ticket. The amount of the lottery ticket is, you know, the hammer price, and everyone else in here recognizes that, wow, if it was a lot of money, that was a pretty good horse, but then they need to run. So it's kind of, it's great, but then you realize, oh geez, now it all starts.
You know, it's been a childhood dream. I mean, I used to go to Aqueduct in Belmont when I was 13, 14-year-old kid. My parents don't know, but sometimes cutting out of school and, you know, with $20 in my pocket, bet $2 a race, and, you know, I was addicted ever since. You know, I always said when I get old, I want to own a racehorse, and 10 years ago, I owned my first racehorse. And to me, it's watching these beautiful animals run down the stretch at 45 miles an hour, and, you know, the whole game, the handicapping, the, you know, the Saratoga racetrack, the people, the jockeys, the silks, the competitive nature, you know, winning, losing. It's just so exciting. It's become a family event where from my 88-year-old grandmother to my 9-year-old niece, we have 40, 50 people at the races. And, you know, it's like an added day to the holiday. You know, you have Thanksgiving, you have Christmas, you have Easter, and then you have one of the grade ones or big races. And, you know, and I get to name them after some of my family members. And it's just a lot of fun when you treat everyone, friends and family.
They're coming down to the finish. Stop Charging Maria has won the Alabama.
The goal was to hopefully advertise that she's a big spender and maybe embarrass her to the point where she might think about spending. It's actually done the opposite to where now she thinks she's got a reputation uphold and she's got Stop Spending Maria, Stop Shopping Maria, Stop Charging Maria, Unlimited Budget. It's kind of backfired. Now she also watches the purse. And if the horse wins, she figures out what the horse wins and thinks that's fun money to spend.
Every time a foal's born, you're thinking about what it might be and what it might become.
The backside of the horses, that's why we're all here. That, you know, if not for the horsemen and the horses, there wouldn't be a derby.
Being able to see the, like, the grandstand from the racetrack point of view, like, it's really outrageous.
Here they come, and it's anybody's race.
And Swaps from California is the 1955 Kentucky Derby champion.
And it's Secretariat that wins it by 2.5 lengths.
It's a different race, and it has to be on your resume.
Now gets to go to the winner's circle. It's Churchill Downs on Derby Day.
For a lot of Americans, that is racing. The Kentucky Derby is racing.
On the first Saturday in May, more than 170,000 people will fill these seats at Churchill Downs, where they're going to witness history in the making. Not just any history, it's the 150th running of the Kentucky Derby. And what a race it's going to be to see in person this year. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for this WHAS 11 News special presentation. I'm Doug Proffitt. After the race, the winner of the 150th Derby will come right here to the historic winner's circle to get the garland of roses, where 149 other Kentucky Derby winners have been since 1875. They are continuing the legacy of the fastest 2 minutes in sports. It was May 17, 1875, when Aristides won the first Kentucky Derby in front of a crowd of 10,000 people. But it was another 20 years before the iconic spires of Churchill Downs first welcomed racing fans. Over the next century, traditions were created.
And Swaps is only the second California bred colt to earn the Garland of Roses here at Churchill Downs in Louisville.
Champions were crowned.
It's Secretariat drawing out. Turcotte just sitting on him, and it's Secretariat that wins it by 2.5 lengths.
And history was made. At the center of it all, of course, is the historic track, which first opened in this spot in South Louisville when the gates opened in 1875. It's a special place to so many people behind the scenes. And our Shane McAllister is talking to one man who, for this place, it's more than just a job. It's a piece of him.
McDonald's has got the golden arches and Nike's got the swoosh. We've got the Twin Spires.
Walking across one of the many balconies at Churchill Downs, Greg Bush is face to face with a flood of memories.
I look out across there, you know, and I see where I got married. You know, that's really cool.
Exchanging vows in 1993 in the winner's circle. An easy choice, he said.
Where else would I get married? With all the connections I had here, you know, the love of this place. She did shoot me down when I said we should come up on horseback. She wasn't going for that one, though.
The tradition of the track ties back to almost every part of his life.
We've got two puppies, Rosie and Oakley, for roses and oaks.
Even the birth of his daughter. Another negotiation with his bride.
If you have this baby on Derby weekend, it's like we're going to name her Derby, and the middle name will be whoever the winning jockey is. It's like, and it was a chuckle, laugh, laugh. And she said, well, how about Darby? It's like, oh. And we like that.
I do's, dogs, and a daughter all traced back here. His home away from home as early as high school.
When I was in high school, I thought that I wanted to be a jockey. And so I did work in the stable area with the horses. But that was short-lived. Genetics got me. I decided that was not something I wanted to do for the rest of my life.
Instead, he built a career on the other side of the turf, earning a degree he could use behind a wagering window.
When I graduated from college, I had offers from other businesses to go to work for them. And it's like, no, I enjoy being around the races.
He found himself full-time at Churchill Downs in 1991, when the track was a totally different place.
I want to describe it as a large battleship. It was just a big white building that had all the emergency staircases on the outside of it. And again, it was an older looking building.
Since then, the racetrack has reinvented itself time and time again, something that has come with challenges at times. He remembers Derby 130 in 2004.
This building did not exist. We ran the Derby. It was the demolition Derby. There was no clubhouse building here. So all of these seats that were going to long-term be built and the seats that had been here before we tore it down got moved to the infield. We built a 4-acre tent in the infield, which you could tell it was a tent if you looked up. But it had hard walls, all the amenities that you had in this building, but it was out in the infield. That was the year that we had a torrential downpour as the race ran. I remember watching video that day, and there were people swimming in the infield.
Another race day that stands out, 2007, when months of preparation led up to a visit from the Queen of England.
So from the time we were notified that she was coming, we had, I believe it was like 32 meetings with our Secret Service, the United States Secret Service, and their counterparts over in England, doing the planning on when is she coming? How is she getting here? What's her path from the time she enters the property, pulls up to a gate? I remember the first meeting, we're standing out in the parking lot where she was going to come in, and they asked where that manhole cover went to. They were afraid, you know, there some ninja was going to come out and do something dastardly.
Churchill staff, known for a focus on hospitality, went above and beyond to make Derby Day one the Queen would never forget.
Our chef at the time with Levy's, he actually created a special blend of tea because she enjoyed her afternoon tea every day, so she could have her own Derby tea while she was here.
He calls that year a high. Of course, there have been lows. 2020 was difficult. The Derby was rescheduled for a Saturday in September, something Greg says they would do differently if they could go back now.
When we were making the plans, we felt as though we might come out of COVID earlier than we did, and we'd be able to have a stands full of people. So that's why we moved it to September. Obviously, we didn't get to do that. We ended up with just the horsemen that were racing with us that day. We're the only ones that were allowed to come out. So we probably would have run it in the spring, hindsight. But that was a crystal ball we didn't have.
No crystal ball, but he can give you a peek into the past. Greg's co-workers consider his office a treasure trove of sorts, from the wacky wobblers,
all the bobbleheads up here,
to the more unusual artifacts.
Triple Crown winning American Pharaoh poop.
He knows how to appreciate the best of horse racing history, a loyalty to the tradition and to the people who came before him, including one in particular.
He's looking down and smiling.
His dad had a 71-year career at Churchill Downs. Everything Greg does today, he says he does with his dad in mind.
He used to tell me how proud I made him. That, you know, when he would see me rising and getting to where I had and accomplishments, that he was very proud.
That pride resonates in the Churchill Downs leader, who looks forward to every Derby day. That's when he gets to see his passion for the races reflected on more than 100,000 faces.
It's the greatest place on earth.
Having a horse make it to the Kentucky Derby and then win is no easy job. Perhaps nobody knows that better than the trainers. Dwayne Lucas has been at it for decades. He's won 4 Kentucky Derbies. And as our sports director Ken Spencer found out, he has no plans to hang up his saddle just yet.
It's another day of training under the twin spires at Churchill Downs for Dwayne Lucas.
I thrive on that. I thrive on that competition of the big arena, the tough race.
As it always does, the alarm on this morning went off at 3:30. The 88-year-old Hall of Fame trainer is still going strong.
I just stay away from the sofa. Everybody I know that gets on that sofa, they start aging.
If you don't believe him, just ask his wife, Lori. She often joins him in his office. If these walls could talk, concrete covered by history and inspiration.
I can't keep up with him. We're 17 years apart and I can't keep up with him.
After switching over from quarter horses to thoroughbreds in 1968, the goal was simple.
As soon as I started switching over, I realized that the Derby was the one that you wanted on your resume.
Lucas attended his first Kentucky Derby in 1980. Genuine Risk captured the Garland of Roses that day. He still remembers his feelings from the stands.
You feel like you're in the big leagues, and you better step it up.
He was hooked. He entered his first horse in the Derby the very next year, Partez, who finished third to Pleasant Colony. In 1988, an elusive Derby victory was finally his.
Lucas and Stevens, it's a driving finish, winning colors by a head.
When you win that first one, you get all puffed up, you come back to the barn and you say, gosh, I just won the Kentucky Derby and what a great thing. And you really think it's you and you soak it up.
Lucas wins it.
Lucas would capture 3 more Derby wins, Thunder Gulch in 1995, Grindstone in 1996, and Charismatic in 1999.
Charismatic trained by Lucas on the outside.
It's the victory with Grindstone that is the most special because he was able to get W.T. Young and Overbrook Farm to the winner's circle on the first Saturday in May.
We embraced and exchanged some words, and I think that moment was very special to him, obviously, and very special to me.
Through the years, Lucas has seen several of his assistant trainers go out on their own and accomplish great things in the sport.
It allowed you the opportunity to work with some really good horses. It allowed you some responsibility, you know, on your own while still under sort of a coaching umbrella.
I didn't hire anybody that I didn't think would go out on his own eventually. If they didn't have that drive and passion that I thought someday they'd walk in and say, boss, I'm going to try it on my own, I didn't want him.
With all of his accomplishments, the outside of his barn looks more like a record book. Recently, the Kentucky Derby Museum honored Lucas with their first ever Lifetime Achievement Award. In total, Lucas has saddled 49 Derby contenders. He's always looking for the next one.
Next year, we have absolutely got the best yearling crop last year that we bought that are now 2-year-olds. They're the best we've had.
Absolutely no sign of slowing down.
I'm only going to be 89, so, I mean, what the hell? I told my wife I'll only do this till I'm 95, and then I'll probably back off.
We'll believe it when we see it.
The journey to the winner's circle right here actually begins 3 years before the horses ever enter a starting gate on farms across the United States. In the heart of horse country here in Kentucky sits the famed Spendthrift Farm, where for decades they've bred and raised Derby contenders. Brooke Hash takes us to Lexington.
The Kentucky Derby, it's really the central race in American racing. If you meet somebody from outside the industry, there's one question that you're going to get. Have you won the Kentucky Derby?
Ned Toffey says there are two special moments for a horse owner on Derby Day. The walk from the backstretch.
Looking at this wall of people, 170,000 strong, is really special, really breathtaking.
And then there's the winner's circle.
We were fortunate enough in 2020 to win the Kentucky Derby with Authentic.
The year when COVID kept fans at home.
It just was a very strange day. It felt nothing like a typical Kentucky Derby until the gates opened. And then you really became focused on that field of horses and rooting Authentic home.
Authentic has won the Kentucky Derby!
It's a long road to get to this track, and for thoroughbreds like Authentic, their journey starts here.
I'm Ned Toffey. I'm the general manager at Spendthrift Farm.
Nestled on 1,200 acres in the heart of horse country.
In 2003, Wayne Hughes asked me to come run his farm. He didn't even have a farm at the time. He just said, I'm going to buy a farm and I'd love you to come run it for me. When I found out that he had bought Spendthrift Farm, it was a little bit like somebody in baseball saying, well, I bought Fenway Park. Would you come run it for me?
There's no shortage of stories on this farm.
I got a tour here when I was about 4 years old in 1968.
And then there's the royal visit from Queen Elizabeth back in the 80s.
Seattle Slough was the still to this day the only undefeated Triple Crown winner. And he was one of the horses that she came here to see. So that's really a great moment in Spendthrift history.
Years later, the farm fell into disrepair. But new ownership in the early 2000s helped restore it to its former glory.
I think my favorite spot on the farm is the old original wooden stud barn. We restored it. When I look at it, I feel like we got everything right. And it really, I think it encompasses everything that Spendthrift's about.
Breeding champions is a full-time job.
It's round the clock.
Trying to create the perfect match for the next generation of great athletes, factoring in their speed, endurance, pedigree, and temperament.
We have 27 stallions. We have the largest stallion roster in North America, and we bred over 3,400 mares last year.
Most days, these farm roads are filled with trailers transporting one mare after another into the breeding barn.
Breeding on a thoroughbred farm is a very highly choreographed, where there's about five people in the breeding shed with the mare and the stallion, making sure that everything goes as safely and efficiently as it possibly can.
I didn't realize how big of an operation this is.
Yeah, most people don't.
The majority of mares are brought in for the process, so fewer than 100 call Spendthrift home, which means any given year, the farm welcomes about 70 babies.
Newborn foals are, I would say on average, are about 125 pounds at birth. So it's a big baby.
The farm holds a lot of promise, and those sired buy into Mischief, its leading stallion.
He's a horse that we raced and then retired to stud here. He started at a fairly modest stud fee of about $12,500. He now stands for $250,000. He is 5 years in a row now the leading general sire in North America. And the last time that was done was in the 1960s by a horse named Bold Ruler, who sired Secretariat. And prior to that, the last time it was done was 1870 by a horse named Lexington.
At 19 years old, Into Mischief also happens to be the sire of Authentic, who's since retired from racing and joined his dad back in the stables.
Their stalls are right across from each other, and Into Mischief can look across the aisleway and be a proud papa.
This year, there'll be no fewer than half a dozen horses with this family's pedigree running in the Oaks and Derby.
And we'll be rooting them on.
And then it's back to business.
We're always looking for the next horse. We're always looking for the next big sire, the next big broodmare. That is really what sort of drives us every day.
According to the Jockey Club, 17,200 thoroughbred foals were registered in the United States last year, but only 20 of them can make it to the starting gate on the first Saturday in May.
I always say I think part of my success as a female was the fact that I didn't really, you know, it wasn't overcoming the obstacles, it was that I just didn't really see them.
In an industry once dominated by men, women are making names for themselves in horse racing. The progress that's been made and the work still to be done. On this track, there's one division, one field of competitors, and one chance to win. Horse racing is one of the few of the major sports where men and women go head-to-head. In the storied history of the Kentucky Derby, six women have made it to the field of 20. Helmets on, heads down, the jockeys raced ahead, creating a space where one didn't exist for decades. Here's Grace McKenna.
Each May, 23-year-old thoroughbreds race for glory. Whether or not they gallop into history when the race is over, the garland given, they have lives left to lead. That is where Rosie Naprovnik comes in.
And the horses are not really retired then, in a way, you know?
They're just retired from racing, yeah. There's so much life. Like, they live into their, you know, late 20s, 30s, so there's a lot of life left.
Naprovnik's off-track sports horses trains retired racehorses for new jobs, like dressage, show jumping, barrel racing.
What inspires me so much is, like, when they come off the track and they know nothing but traffic life, and then they're just so open to whatever it is you throw at them.
Off track is essentially a second act for retired racehorses. It's actually a second act for Naprovnik herself.
Oh, hi, Mama.
Before retiring in 2014, she spent years on the front side of horses' careers, in turn, winning a place in history.
Rosie Naprovnik is the only woman to have won the Kentucky Oaks, and she did it twice. There's only been six women who have ridden in the Kentucky Derby in the entire 150 years of the Kentucky Derby.
Kentucky Derby Museum curator Jessica Whitehead says women weren't in the spotlight in the early days of the Derby. In fact, it wasn't even legal for them to become jockeys until 1968, when Kathy Kuzner successfully sued for the right to a license.
Kathy Kuzner said, listen, I can ride horses as well as any of these male jockeys.
At breakneck speed, Diane Crump raced for the record books 2 years later, the first woman to ride in the most exciting 2 minutes in sports.
That was an incredible moment because of the visibility of the Kentucky Derby.
In the decades after, women built their careers racing at the highest levels, including 8 more Kentucky Derbies.
It's a special race, but it takes a lot to get there.
Naprovnik's shot came when she was 23. It had been a dream for years, spurred by childhood pony racing and a movie about Triple Crown winners.
I always wanted to be a jockey, and I didn't see the difference between men and women when I was 7.
No one would have known there was a woman in the field when she rode her very first race under trainer Dickie Small.
I rode under AR so that nobody would know that I was a girl when I was first coming about.
Naprovnik won that race and then won again and again, taking her all the way to the 2011, 2013, and 2014 Derbies.
Being able to see the grandstand from the racetrack point of view, like, there's only so many people that even get to see that view, and it's really outrageous. It's very cool.
In 2012, Naprovnik became the first woman to win the Kentucky Oaks, streaking past jockey John Velasquez, riding Believe You Can.
Turning for home, like, nose and nose with Johnny on the favorite, and knowing that I was going to beat him was, like, one of the best moments of my life.
Naprovnik feels she got a fair shot and earned her place as a rider, gender notwithstanding. Some of her early predecessors, though, faced vocal opposition.
There were Derby-winning jockeys who were saying in national publications, your spaghetti's burning, get back in the kitchen, to these women.
But with the right to ride secured, those early female jockeys charted a path for future generations.
Still, there's been no woman to win the Kentucky Derby, and a lot of that has to do with opportunities.
These days, women claim roles across the horse racing industry, though expert Kaitin Bradar says that wasn't always the case.
I look back to somebody like Julie Crone and I say, you know, she was the only one. And she inspired so many to give it a try.
Radar is hopeful for the future of the sport in the hands of its promising young jockeys.
In New York, you have jockeys like Katie Davis and you have Maddie Oliver. So now it's more commonplace to have women in the jocks room, and the exceptions are the places that don't have any women riders.
After all, it's been 150 years since the first Kentucky Derby, much fewer since the first female jockeys took the reins.
It changed so quickly, in my estimation, even though I know a lot of people would think it changed very slowly.
In the grand scheme of things, it's only a matter of time in a sport where each second counts.
I won 5 races on Cantonic.
Napravnik knows the feeling of those seconds well.
We have Old Ironsides, who I rode in 2006 and 8, or 6 till 2008.
She credits her success to strategy, determination, and a refusal to see obstacles.
Keeping your head down and doing your job and always trying to improve is, I think, you know, what the journey is all about.
A journey shared by the women behind her and the women ahead, who will one day ride to victory on the first Saturday in May.
A witness to the history over the decades, Churchill Downs and the Twin Spires.
That over the 130 years, they have taken on an iconic role recognizable around the world.
But they weren't always there for the derbies, the history behind the iconic structures, and what may have inspired them. You are looking at the true landmark, even the company trademark logo of Churchill Downs, the freshly painted Twin Spires. Recognized around the world, they say the Kentucky Derby and Louisville to those who see them. They are well cared for here. But there's one thing about the 150th Kentucky Derby. Those Twin Spires, well, they are not 150 years old. In fact, they came 20 years later after the first Derby. I happen to notice over the decades around Louisville, many other buildings in our city built by the designer of the spires. So we wanted to know, what inspired the spires? We caught up with historian Tom Owen.
They've stood right here through America at war, tornadoes, snowstorms, but they weren't made for tragedy.
They now take on eternal springtime. They suggest beauty and tradition and the blossoming of beginnings and new beginnings.
The Twin Spires at Churchill Downs tower over triumph.
And they're off.
The first Kentucky Derby was 1875, but didn't have Twin Spires. In fact, it didn't even have the grandstand where the grandstand was built in 1895.
We asked Louisville's most famous historian, 84-year-old Tom Owen, to unlock the mystery of who thought of those spires.
There were new owners of Churchill Downs, and there was a new day coming. The spires were kind of an architectural afterthought. I'm suggesting to you they were not a big deal in 1895.
Plus, he takes us on a tour of Louisville. D.X. Murphy, the firm that built the grandstand and the spires in 1895, was actively building other remarkable structures across the city at the same time.
They surely must have been the busiest architectural firm in town.
Like this public library at 17th and Jefferson.
So the spires were only 18 years old. They were brand new nearly when they came down to this area and built this library.
Well, I'm telling you, this firm, they did unbelievable number of projects. Yes, the library, 1913.
And St. Patrick's School at 15th and Market. So if the spires were an afterthought, how do they become so world famous?
I believe this building could very, very likely be the inspiration of Joseph Valdez's Twin Spires at Churchill Downs.
The Louisville Trust Building in downtown Louisville at 5th and Market. The spark for the spires. And who was Joseph Dominic Valdez?
He's a Louisville kid. He lives with his family at 23 or 24 years of age at 20th and Grand in the California neighborhood.
Valdez went to St. X and was hired on not as an architect, but as a draftsman by D.X. Murphy.
We also believe that Valdez learned just basic construction skills from his dad, who was the carpenter.
Back to this building. The D.X. Murphy office was located right across the street from it during its construction.
it was finished 2 years before the spires were built.
Literally under his nose, because all during construction and immediately after completion, Joseph Valdez saw the Louisville Trust Building.
Here are the original architect drawings of the spires, preserved today by the architecture firm Luckin and Farley. DX Murphy is listed, but Valdez is not mentioned anywhere on the plans. Take a look at the spires. Tall but thin windows, under the curved archways.
There is the inspiration of the spires with the octagonal windows around it. And then look at all of the rounded arches, both on the top of the tower and the second level of the tower. And you see the same rounded arches embodied in both the grandstand and in the twin spires. But I'm telling you, the graceful inspiration for Joseph Valdez, likely, according to me at least, and some others, was the Louisville Trust Building.
Some other examples by DX Murphy before the spires: Presentation Academy, the turret on top of the Fraser History Museum.
So when Joseph Valdez said, this grandstand needs something, where do you think he started?
There had to be a reason for them, more than just an afterthought. Owen believes it was this.
He suggested that they were pleasantly attractive, but that they were not architecturally significant.
Ironically, Valdez would never, ever visit Churchill on its biggest day.
He loved to go to the races, but never, never went on Derby Day, because he was always kind of fretful that the heavy loads of all of those fans in the grandstand might cause a railing to fall off and somebody get hurt. And so he was fretful about that.
But he designed it.
He designed it. But yes, he designed it. But he was 24 years old.
So as we celebrate 150 years of the Derby, we actually honor 130 years of the Twin Spires. And it would be none other than Matt Wynn, the president of Churchill Downs, who made the Derby world famous, who summed up the spires the best to their creator.
Matt Wynn later said to Joe, Joe, when you die, those twin spires will endure and will never be removed as a tribute to you.
And there you have it. One more perfect description of them: enduring. So why were the spires built 20 years after the first Kentucky Derby? Well, this grandstand is not the original grandstand. The first one, built in 1875 when the track opened, was on the backside. It was facing west into the hot afternoon sun every day. The race fans were so uncomfortable, the owners of Churchill Downs decided to tear that one down, and they rebuilt the new one right here in this very spot. While the spires have remained unchanged over the years, the same can't be said for the track surrounding them. When the first grandstand was constructed in 1875, the track's paddock was just a simple building standing beside it. Over the next 100 years, other versions of the paddock would be built, including a new tunnel that would take horses from the saddling area right to the track. Then in 1986, a new paddock, complete with state-of-the-art tote board, was built. It would remain until Churchill Downs announced a $200 million redesign of the space, opening just in time for Derby 150.
This is the most transformational project that we've done here at Churchill Downs. It brings back into the focus the horses. Right when you walk through the paddock gate, you're going to see horses saddled beneath the twin spires. I think the twin spires are back in focus, and that's very important to us. It's our version of the Nike swoosh or the McDonald's M or any logo that's familiar. The twin spires say Churchill Downs.
Still to come, and the history of the Kentucky Derby runs deep. But for decades, the faces and the names of the early jockeys who dominated the first Kentucky Derbies were ignored. African-American jockeys were the early winners in the race, going back to the very first Derby. Now historians are working to ensure their contributions aren't forgotten. Here's Eric King.
This historic track has seen its fair share of thrilling and memorable moments. And every year on the first Saturday in May, there's a collective hope that this too will go down among the very best. We share that history and those traditions together. We want to make an effort to ensure that we're sharing all of that history. some of it might surprise you.
For decades, African-American jockeys played a pivotal role in shaping the sport of horse racing, particularly here at the Kentucky Derby. In fact, 13 of the first 15 Kentucky Derby winners were guided to victory by African-American riders. Names like Oliver Lewis, Alonzo Clayton, and Isaac Murphy became legendary for their skill, agility, and unparalleled connection with their horses.
Early years, African-Americans are the ones really making the impact on the race. 13 to 15 jockeys in that very first race in 1875. We look at the first 28 runnings of the Kentucky Derby up until 1902. Over half of those are won by African-American jockeys.
Chris Goodlett is a curator at the Kentucky Derby Museum.
Highlights the contributions of African-Americans to thoroughbred racing. So we go back to the era before the Kentucky Derby, going back to the 1820s. It's a very Kentucky-focused exhibit. At that time, racing was pretty much run by the enslaved. Southern economy is a plantation economy, and the enslaved are taking care of the horses, which includes riding the horses.
Segregation and Jim Crow laws were responsible for dwindling the numbers of African Americans in the horse racing industry as a whole. Several reports show white jockeys began violently attacking their African American counterparts by boxing them out during races, running them into rails, and hitting them with riding crops. These attacks prevented black jockeys from finishing in the money, which led horse owners and trainers to stop employing African-American jockeys. For some owners and trainers, it could have been a matter of prejudice. For others, it was perhaps a business decision. But the history of their successes lives on, even through people still working at Churchill Downs today. Last year, we introduced you to Bill Vest, who's the backside security manager at the track. He is now in his 49th year. He told us one of his greatest privileges is having learned from the best.
Well, I came here in 1975, the Saturday morning after Foolish Pleasure had won the Derby the week Saturday prior. And I was young, and I was in awe of this place. And I thought, wow, I've made it to the big time. This is Churchill Downs, the Derby. Yeah, and I was a groom then, you know, learning my trade. Back then, and I was fortunate enough to be here when the old guard, I like to call them, the old African-American grooms, you're talking about the best horsemen in the world, they were here. I got to walk with them.
The dedication and expertise of African-Americans are woven into the fabric of the Kentucky Derby, reminding us that it's more than just a race. It's a diverse celebration of tradition and resilience. It's that history the Kentucky Derby Museum wants to honor and celebrate.
Black jockeys in the Kentucky Derby disappeared in 1921. It would be another 79 years before another African-American jockey would take the reins. That was in the year 2000. Still to come here on The Greatest 2 Minutes, they're as big as the history of this big derby, the Rose Garland and the Mint Julep.
There are only a few places in American culture where you can wear a derby hat.
An evolution of derby hats and fashion over the last 100 years. For decades, the real stars of the Derby haven't been found in the paddock or on the red carpet. Instead, they're the style icons who manage to craft the most stunning, extravagant, or outlandish race day looks. With 150 years of practice under their belts, Derby goers show their passion for fashion with a long line of trendsetters going back to the earliest days of the race. Here's Grace McKenna.
It's bright, it's bold, it's a sure bet. Fashion on the first Saturday in May is as ever-changing as the field of competitors and the Kentucky weather. But even 150 years ago, before the pastels and the patterns, the aim was the same.
Horse racing was a social sport. You were coming to see and be seen at this place that was pretty much the apex of society.
The clothes from those early years tell the stories of their time, stories now preserved by Kentucky Derby Museum curator Jessica Whitehead.
There was a really significant transition in the way men and women were dressing in American culture in the transition from the 1900s, 1910s into the 1920s and 1930s, and that was the innovation of sportswear.
Though modern fabrics and colors widened the spectrum of possibility, decades of derby goers past still found ways to stand out.
They call it shrimp pink.
In 2024, though, even more iconic than an electric ensemble is what tops it off.
This whole idea of the derby hat, that was a major change in derby fashion history that came around, you know, right at this big transitional time in American culture.
Whitehead says during the 50s and 60s, as hats became less common in daily life, they found a new purpose as a derby staple. And from the very beginning, people took risks with whimsy.
There's always been a tension between really traditional fashion and really traditional ensembles and sort of outlandish. I just love how clever it is to make a make Viking horns into the twin spires. It's just inspired.
A wide-brimmed hat was long the standard look. The Whitehead says in more recent years, a European transplant, the Fascinator, wedged its way to the front of the pack. From the infield to the suites, derby headwear can feel like a clash of cultures. Handcrafted masterpieces keep a firm grip on some.
I made the hat in 1981, and it's people just really enjoy it.
While others turn to master milliners as the arbiters of taste.
And it looks chaotic, but I actually know where everything is.
So. Alana Kogan, a.k.a. the Hat Doctor, started making hats while in Kentucky for med school to pay off student debt.
I thought that I was a fashion expert coming from New York, and I've seen it all. But then when I saw the fashion at the Kentucky Derby, I was just mesmerized.
Necessity, ever the mother of invention, became a passion. Now, the full-time radiologist is also one of the Kentucky Derby Museum's featured milliners and chief trendsetters.
People really want to show what they have this year. They want to show their personal style. They want to put their best foot forward and have a gorgeous outfit head to toe.
For Derby 150, she says reds and greens are having a moment, as well as shapes that nod to the past and call back tradition.
Especially for Derby 150, I think people kind of want to have that classic look of a wide brim hat.
Tradition is Whitehead's bread and butter. This summer, she has the tall task of documenting the decades in a new exhibit, a collection of past derby ensembles sourced from people's own closets and wardrobes.
We're so excited to be celebrating the 150th anniversary of the Kentucky Derby.
The goal is to tell the story of fashion from 1875 to 2024 and every year in between.
This is a great example of the way that fashion had to sort of adapt to the times and how derby fashion can help us tell the story of the Kentucky Derby.
After all, if the clothes make the man, then fashion history is really about our shared story.
You're sending a message about your individuality, about your selfhood, about where we are at this particular time in history.
And that is a story worth remembering.
Wearing their hats and colorful suits, you'll often see race fans with a mint julep in their hands. Well, that's a tradition that's a century old. It dates back to 1939, when the mint julep became the official drink of the Kentucky Derby. That's the same year Churchill Downs created the official souvenir glass after noticing people took home glasses the year before. But the history of the mint julep in Kentucky goes back much further, back to the 19th century. The iconic silver cups were often given away as prizes for horse races in the early 1800s. And historians say they have every reason to believe it was at that very first derby in 1875. On the first Saturday in May, the crowds filling Churchill Downs will pause and join together to sing My Old Kentucky Home. The horses will walk from the paddock out on the historic track past the cheering crowd right to the starting gate. The University of Louisville Marching Band will be performing the song they've done for almost every year since 1936. It's just one tradition during an event that is so rich with traditions and history. From the garland of roses to the pageantry of the fashion to the love of the horses themselves, the Kentucky Derby is unlike any other race. It has survived through world wars, a Great Depression, the Great Flood of 1937, tornadoes, and of course, two global pandemics, 1918 and 2020. And now, just before 7 p.m. on the first Saturday in May, we will do it all over again. But this year, the Grand Race enters rare territory for any sporting event in the world. That's because we will be wondering, on the edge of our seats, who will take home the garland of roses in the 150th running of the Kentucky Derby? It truly is the greatest 2 minutes.
Welcome to the 2024-25 Kentucky Derby Prep Race Qualifying Schedule. As the Derby Prep season kicks off at Churchill Downs on Saturday, September the 14th, with the Iroquois Stakes. How this works, each race has a point scale value assigned to it. I broke it down into five different categories. Minor races, winners get 10 quality points. Second place gets 5, third 3, fourth 2, and 1 point for fifth place. Mid-minor winner gets 20 points, mid-major 30, or 30 plus. The Fukuru of Japan is a 40-point race. It's also a mid-major. Major race winners collect 50 points, second for 25, and then automatic bid winner gets 100 points, second for 50, third 25, and so on. Note, 50 plus combined quality points horses likely get into the Kentucky Derby on May the 3rd, 2025. Top 20 horses qualify for the gate. There are a total of 47 Kentucky Derby prep qualifying races. The United States holds 36 of them, with 7 automatic bids, 7 major races, 9 mid-minor races, and 12 minor races, with 1 mid-majors being the Breeders' Cup Juvenile. The UAA Derby is an automatic bid and totaled with Europe for 7, and Japan has 4 total with 2 mid-majors, a mid-minor, and a minor. Let's do this week's Iroquois Stakes breakdown so you know what you're looking at. And the rest of the schedule will be set to music. The Grade 3 Iroquois Stakes is run at Churchill Downs in Louisville, Kentucky in the USA on September 14th, 2024. They'll travel a mile on the dirt, purse of $300,000. It's a minor points race for 10 for the winner, 5 for second, 3 for third, 2 for fourth, and 1 point for fifth place. Let it rip!
We're close to the race. We didn't want to do much. We pretty much did what we thought.
He didn't do much of a gallop up. Was that kind of just by design there?
I told her not to gallop up much because I didn't want to do too much with him this close. He could have done a little more than she let him, but that's what it was. I like his pedigree. I think he's got a pedigree to do this very much so, and his running style probably complements it too. If he's good enough, he'll show up. But he's got. We've got something to work with. I'm comfortable with the horse, the style, the pedigree. Very good mother on the dam side. So we'll. We'll go from there.
I think there's 7 horses that have won over the track, you obviously being one. Does that an advantage more for the trainers?
I think that would be all right, except they changed the track. Yeah, the track is a lot different than it was. You know, it's got more sand in it now. It's got a more base, more cushion, quite a bit deeper. Horses are getting over it good. I think, though, it is a track that the affinity for it could show up on certain horses. I don't put a lot of credence on the fact that, you know, 6 or 7 have won over it. That doesn't jump up very high to me.
You're talking about pedigrees. Your jockey has a good pedigree and everything. What have you liked about him that gives you the confidence to put him on these horses in each big spot?
Well, you know, I worked with him in Hot Springs, and he passed all the tests, and the horse actually ran his best race of his life with him on it. So I wouldn't change. I just said he's had experience, he's this, that, but he's very smart. He's got a lot of confidence in what he does. That's not going to bother him to get out there with these guys. I feel real comfortable about that. That part I'm comfortable with. The horse will tell us, but the rider I think will be just fine.
How rare is it to have a rider this still young to have to already be showing that this level of confidence that he has?
I think the last time that happened, it was a spectacular bid maybe with Franklin.
1979.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. Way back then, he was what? Steve Crofton was what?
78.
Yeah, he was what,
16?
18,
I think.
18, yeah. Well, my writer's got a master's degree and is 20-some years old.
I like that stat, too. Right, yeah. The master's stat.
Smartest trainer jockey duo out there, right?
That's the only one, yeah.
Confidence riding someone this young when he comes from a family like he does?
Yes. Yeah, his background is horse hunting all the way. You know, he's got a really good pedigree to be a horseman and be a jockey. Physically, he doesn't fit. He's too tall, too skinny. You know, but he's got so much horsemanship that he overcomes it. He actually, we used to say in athletics, they look good in the lobby. He doesn't look good in the lobby. He looks better on the horse.